Tonight we're very happy to welcome Dr. Chris Forbes, who is on the Faculty of Ancient History at Macquarie University. Some of you might remember that Dr. Forbes joined us a number of years ago, I can't remember how many, and gave us a wonderful presentation on the ancient times, the church in ancient times. Dr. Forbes is actually not only teaching at Macquarie, but was also a graduate of Macquarie University, I won't say which year. He actually went out into the real world of secondary schools to teach there for 2 years before returning to take up a postgraduate research award at Macquarie, and also worked part-time at the Australian Institute of Archaeology. And he completed his PhD at Macquarie while teaching full-time, and has been lecturing in ancient history ever since. His particular interests are in the areas, very relevant to us today, of New Testament history, Greek and Roman history of ideas, Alexander the Great, and the Hellenistic Age, which is roughly from 350 BC to 100 AD. He also coordinates the Master of Arts program in Early Christian and Jewish Studies, and is the Vice President of the Society for the Study of Early Christianity at Macquarie University. So today, Dr. Forbes will be talking to us about the resurrection of Christ and looking at it from a historical perspective. If I can suggest to you to keep the questions in your minds for the moment, unless perhaps it's something that just is to clarify something that Dr. Forbes has said, but there will be, I'm just reminding you, a question and answer session after the talk, which is quite lengthy, so you'll have every chance to ask all your difficult and thorny questions there. In the meantime, if you'd kindly give your attention to Dr. Forbes, and if we could welcome him, please.
Thank you for welcoming me again, and my apologies for giving you a few panicky minutes when it was a matter of taking a wrong turn. I'm going to be speaking to you as an historian. Oh, yes, handouts should be in your hands. While the handouts are coming around, I'll just explain that I've taught at Macquarie, as was read to you, for about half of my life now. And my focus in ancient history starts with the history of philosophy in the Greek and Roman world in the 6th century BC, comes down through and particularly cuts in with Alexander the Great around about 350 BC, and from there I go down to about 150 AD, which in Coptic terms I'm aware is very early church indeed, but I'm afraid that the 500 years between Alexander the Great and 150 AD 500 years should be enough for anyone, I think, and it certainly is enough for me. The handouts you have in front of you, and I'm hoping one will come up to me as well, so I can just check where we're up to, will give you an outline of the things I'm going to say, and also some documents that go along with what I'm going to be saying. But you needn't go through all that now. For the moment, you just need to know that I think for most Christians, the question of Christianity's significance historically, the question of Christianity's relevance, hangs on the question of Jesus' resurrection. Without Jesus' resurrection, Christianity might be nice, it might be appealing, it might be socially useful, it might be good for people, or it might not, but it would not be true. And we ought to be clear that when the early Christians said that they believed Jesus had risen from the dead and was alive, they did not mean what some people mean now when they say, not very many of them any longer, Elvis lives. Which, as far as I can tell, means yes, 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 I know he's actually dead, but I really care about his music. Or the way some people on the left wing of politics say Che lives, meaning Che Guevara. And what they mean is, yes, yes, I know he's dead, but everything he stands for is still important. When the early Christians claimed that Jesus was alive, had risen from the dead, they did not mean these things. They meant, at an absolutely literal level, that something overwhelmingly miraculous had happened, and Jesus, their leader, who had been executed by the Romans and was well and truly dead and in the grave for a couple of days, was miraculously alive again. They knew that they were making an astonishing claim, and they made it in full awareness of the difficulty. Now, what I want to do is I want to look at four questions, and they are historians' questions, and they're the ones under point B on your printed materials. I want to look at four questions, the first of which is, what is the earliest evidence for this belief? How early back into a Christian history can we track the belief in Jesus' resurrection from the dead, and where is the information coming from? Secondly, I want to ask, how reliably has the evidence for this belief been reported, or have beliefs coloured the reporting in ways that we can detect? Thirdly, I want to ask, where might the belief in a resurrection occurring like this have originated in the world of the first century? And fourthly, I want to ask, how did the early Christians argue for this belief in terms of religious propaganda in their own days? So, let's go through this one by one. What's the earliest evidence of the belief in Jesus' resurrection? And the answer is not the Gospels. The answer is, almost without any doubt at all, 1 Corinthians 15 and the other letters of St. Paul, but particularly 1 Corinthians 15, which was written somewhere between 53 and 55 AD. We don't know more precisely than that, but that's quite precise enough. Notice that not only is St. Paul claiming in 1 Corinthians 15 that Jesus is back from the dead, but he is claiming that Jesus is back from the dead permanently, would never die again, had the life of the world to come already. And what we need to note particularly is that when Paul wrote, somewhere between 53 and 55 AD, what he was saying was already a fixed form of tradition and had been for some time. Now, I think it's worth reading to you the precise words that Paul used when he described this belief. And we're talking about, in, as I said, 53 to 55 AD, because particular things he said will be significant as we go on. Verse 3, what I received, notice he's not claiming he originated this, what I received I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. And Paul doesn't mean as the Scriptures say, he means as the Scriptures prophesied. That he appeared to Peter, and then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born, more literally, one born out of due time. Now notice, what Paul says is, I passed this on to you when I was first with you. And I passed on to you what had already been passed on to me. So when did Paul pass it on to the Corinthians, and when was it passed on to him? Well, we can date Paul's time in Corinth, again within a couple of years, to 50, 51, 52 AD. And the reason we can date it then is that the Acts of the Apostles tells us, and I'll come back to this in a moment, that it happened while a Roman governor by the name of Annius Gallio was the governor in Achaia, the governor of the province of Achaia, based in Corinth. Now we know, because of an inscription carved in stone that Annius Gallio set up a little bit north of Corinth, precisely which year he held the position of governor in Achaia, and it was around 51 AD, and I say around simply because their calendar doesn't start on the same date as ours does. 51 will do. So Gallio's time as governor and Paul's visit to Corinth overlap. Now that gives us a starting point from which we can reconstruct what happened. Somewhere around about 51 AD, St. Paul converted the Corinthians, told them the story of the resurrection, and when he did that in 51, it was already something that had been passed on to him prior to this. Now I'm going to do this with a PowerPoint that I've only tested once or twice, so we'll just have to see how well this works. But what I've got here is a timeline from the death of Jesus, and we can date the death of Jesus fairly decisively on astronomical grounds, to either 30 or 33 AD, with historians a little bit divided as to whether it's 30 or 33, but virtually no one thinking that it isn't one of those two. What Paul tells us is, after his conversion, which we don't have a date for yet, he began to proclaim Jesus in the synagogue, saying, "He's the Son of God." And all who heard him were amazed. Saul became increasingly more powerful and confounded the Jews who lived in Damascus by proving that Jesus was the Messiah. After some time had passed, the Jews plotted to kill him, and their plot became known to Saul. They were watching the gates day and night so they might kill him, but his disciples took him by night and let him down through an opening in the wall, lowering him in a basket. Not the most prestigious way to leave a city, being let down a wall in a basket, but nonetheless. Then he went to Jerusalem. Now, we're lucky that we don't just have the second-hand account of Acts. We also have Paul's own account of this event. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he says, "In Damascus," and now he gives us extra information, "the ethnarch," the ruler of the ethnos, the people, the ethnic group, "under King Aretas, guarded the city of Damascus in order to seize me, but I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands." Clearly we're talking about the same event. How many times can a man be let down a window in the wall in Damascus? But the point about this is it gives us a date, because we know the dates of Aretas. Aretas was the king of the Nabataean Arabs from somewhere around about 6 or 7 BC down to 40 AD. So the event must have happened sometime before 40, but we don't know when. Sometime before 40. Now, we need to add a little bit of extra information. In Galatians, Paul tells us that when he was first converted, verse 16.5, "I did not confer with any human being, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me, but I went away at once into Arabia, and afterwards I returned to Damascus. Then after 3 years I did go up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas," that's Peter, simply the Aramaic form of the Greek Peter, "and stayed with him 15 days, and I did not see any other apostle except James, the Lord's brother." So this tells us now that after Damascus, there's 3 years before Paul went to Jerusalem the first time. He goes on in Galatians. "Then after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me." Now, there are two ways you can count this. You can either count this adding it on to the 3 years, or you can count it as including the 3 years. But one way or another, what you have to do is you've got to get Paul from Jerusalem back to Corinth and functioning in Corinth by 51. Because that's when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia. So you see, now we know that the dates have got to be earlier than that. We were never sure how much earlier than that, but earlier than that they have to be. And in fact, if we shunt them back the minimal amount to make them fit before 51 AD, then what we discover was that the first time Paul was in the mid-30s AD. In other words, somewhere between 5 and 10 years after the events of Jesus' death. Now, I find it impossible to imagine that Paul would spend 2 weeks with Peter and not ask him, "Hey, this business about Jesus' resurrection, tell me about that." So what I'm suggesting to you is that list from 1 Corinthians 15 that I read of who saw what and when they saw it, which was passed on to Paul, which Paul then passed on to the Corinthians, and which he is reminding them of in 53 to 57, that list goes back to the mid-30s AD. In other words, this is the earliest evidence we have for the belief in Jesus' resurrection, and it goes back to within 10 years or less of the events. The Gospels, by comparison, were almost certainly written in the late 60s or the early 70s and into the 80s, so as much as 50 years after the events. But Paul's account goes back to within less than 10 years of the events. That, it seems to me, is a highly significant fact that we need to deal with. Now, the second major question, and we'll just turn this off now so that it's not distracting. The second question that I wanted to ask you was, how reliably has the evidence for this belief been transmitted? And what I want to claim is that the transmission of the story is actually suggestive of restrained reporting, of honest reporting, of honestly confusing events. If you read the accounts in the Gospels of Jesus' resurrection, you will notice that there are obvious gaps in the story. There are things nobody knows. One of the things nobody knows is what it actually looked like. And the reason nobody knows is nobody was there. They'd all left. There were Roman soldiers guarding the tomb, but that's it. Now, this is not the case in all early Christian writings. There's another document called the Gospel of Peter. Now, this is an intriguing document that was probably written about the turn of the first into the second century AD. There's only one copy of it has ever been found. It's an 8th century AD manuscript in the tomb of a monk in the Egyptian town of Akhmim. And this document is the most remarkable thing because it takes you ringside to the resurrection. Read some of it with me now on page 2 of your printed materials. It starts in the middle of Jesus being tried by Pilate, but I haven't given you all of that, and it goes through to Simon Peter and the others trying to decide what to do after believing in the resurrection, but that's all it is. It's just a torn-off second half of a document that happened to be buried with this particular 8th century monk. Now, here we go. The scribes and the Pharisees and the elders. Oh, sorry, there's one thing I should explain to you. Wherever I've got a phrase or a word in italics there in the text, that's to tell you that this is clearly borrowed from one of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke. It's a pretty strong consensus of scholarship that this so-called Gospel of Peter is not really by Peter at all, written around the turn of the second century, and uses Matthew, Mark and Luke, but it's the way it uses them that's fun. Watch with me. The scribes and Pharisees and elders, being assembled together and hearing that all the people were murmuring and beating their breasts, saying, "If at his death these exceedingly great signs have come to pass, behold how righteous he was." They were afraid, this is the scribes, the Pharisees and the elders, and came to Pilate, saying, "Give us soldiers, so that we may watch his sepulchre for 3 days, lest his disciples come and steal him away." That's clearly borrowed from Matthew's gospel. "And the people suppose that he's risen from the dead and do us harm." And Pilate gave them Petronius the centurion. Isn't it good to know names? None of the biblical gospels tell us who he was. But this author knows, or does he? "With soldiers to watch the sepulchre, and with them there came elders and scribes to the sepulchre, and all who were there, together with the centurion and the soldiers, rolled there a great stone and laid it against the entrance to the sepulchre, and put on it 7 seals. That's rather more than Matthew says they put on it. This author doesn't just use Matthew, he embroiders on Matthew. "Pitched a tent and kept watch. Early in the morning when the Sabbath dawned, there came a crowd from Jerusalem and the country round about to see the sepulchre that had been sealed." Now, do you notice what our author has done? He's made sure there are lots of witnesses. There's soldiers, there's Jewish elders, and there's a crowd of common people. Lots of people saw what happened next, is what he's claiming. "Now, in the night in which the Lord's day dawned, when the soldiers, 2 by 2 in every watch, were keeping guard, there rang out a loud voice in heaven, and they saw the heavens opened, and 2 men come down from there in a great brightness and draw nigh to the sepulchre, and the stone which had been laid against the entrance to the sepulchre started of itself to roll, and gave way to the side, and the sepulchre was opened, and both the young men entered in. And when those soldiers saw this, they awakened their centurion and the elders, for they were also there to assist at the watch." Everyone was there. "And while they were relating what they'd seen, they saw again 3 men come out of the sepulchre. 2 went in, 3 came out. Guess who? And 2 of them sustaining the other, and a cross following them. I presume on its little feet. And the heads of the 2 reaching to heaven, and that of him who was led by them by the hand overpassing the heavens." I don't think this can be understood literally. What it's trying to say is Jesus was huge, but it doesn't know any way to express it. "And they heard a voice out of the heaven crying, 'Hast thou preached to them that sleep?' And from the cross there was heard the answer, 'Yes.'" Now, this is a very dramatic and extraordinary document. And I think what's absolutely clear is it starts where the canonical gospels stop and embroiders and embellishes from there. My point is very simple. The canonical gospels don't tell you things that nobody could have seen. This document does. It invents a whole new group of witnesses and has them seeing remarkable things to make it absolutely clear that everybody knew. Now, if we go on just a little bit into the Gospel of Peter, we discover, "These men therefore took counsel with one another to go and report this to Pilate. And while they were still deliberating, the heavens were again seen to open, and a man descended and entered into the sepulchre. And when those who were of the centurion's company saw this, they hastened by night to Pilate, abandoning the sepulchre which they were guarding, reporting everything they'd seen, being full of disquietude, saying, 'In truth, he was the Son of God,'" which of course one soldier at the crucifixion said in the canonical gospels, but now they're all saying it. "Pilate answered and said, 'I am clean from the blood of the Son of God. Upon such a thing have you decided? In other words, mate, it's not my fault, it's yours. They all came to him, beseeching him and earnestly calling upon him to command the centurion and the soldiers to tell no one what they'd seen, for it is better for us, they said, to make ourselves guilty of the greatest sin before God than to fall into the hands of the people of the Jews and be stoned. Pilate therefore commanded the centurion and the soldiers to say nothing. Now, do you notice what's just happened there? A very nasty little bit of anti-Semitic polemic is what's happened. The Jewish elders said to Pilate, it would be better for us to be convicted of the greatest possible sin than for the news to get out of what's just happened. The Jewish elders are made to blame for keeping the story secret. And the story is secret because Governor Pilate bribes the soldiers not to tell anyone, which explains how this author knows all this. Well, actually not. It makes it utterly baffling how this author knows all this. But it doesn't matter, because this author is simply embroidering and embellishing. And he's not terribly consistent. Now, my point is simple. Compared to this document written at the end of the first century, the Gospels we have in the New Testament look like relatively restrained reporting, because they don't tell you things that no one saw, and they don't tell you things that nobody told because they swore not to. They tell you who saw what, and there are gaps in the story they tell where no one was there. Not only that, but we're in a position to check whether the way the early Christians told the story of Jesus' resurrection had added theological colouring. Because we know from other early Christian writings what the early Christians expected of a resurrection. Now, you may remember that in St. Paul's letters, one of the ways that Paul regularly talks is about Jesus being the firstborn of the dead. And this is because for the early Christians, Jesus' resurrection was logically connected to the great resurrection in the future. His was a little bit of the resurrection happening in the middle of history when all the rest would happen at the end of history. In other words, the early Christians believed there was a connection between resurrection in general and Jesus' resurrection. It seems fairly obvious. And we know if we read 1 Thessalonians, 1 Corinthians, the book of Revelation, that things they expected when the resurrection came included the blast of trumpets from the heavens, the cry of the archangel of God, none of which happens in the Gospels. You see, what I'm suggesting is the Gospels do not read back their own theological views about what a resurrection ought to look like and plonk it into their report about Jesus. They simply report what they believe to be the facts, without theological overlay. Let me give you one striking example of this. If I ask you, when was Jesus raised from the dead, then virtually anyone can give it to me in the words of the Creed, even if they're not a churchgoer or a Christian themselves. On the third day. That's what it says. On the third day he rose again in accordance with the Scriptures. And that's in 1 Corinthians 15. We read it earlier. And it's in the creeds because it's in 1 Corinthians 15. It's very much a feature of the way Paul talks about the resurrection. And for the early Christians, it echoed the words of the prophet Hosea, who in chapter 6, verse 2, said about God, after 2 days he will revive us, and on the third day he will raise us up so that we might live before him. So you see, on the third day language sounded to the early Christians like a prophecy. And they used it that way. And Paul used it that way, and it's been stuck in our mental systems ever since. But do you notice the Gospels don't use it even once? They all say simply, on the day after the Sabbath. In other words, they do not read back into the reports about Jesus their theological beliefs. They simply say, these are the people who saw him, and it happened the day after the Sabbath. Yes, we know it's on the third day, but we're just reporting here. Not only that, but when you look at the Gospels, they don't look as if they've been carefully cut and polished to be credible historical evidence. To be blunt, it's really difficult if you take Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and attempt to jigsaw them together into a coherent account of everything in order. It's actually very difficult to do. I don't think it's impossible, but it's certainly not easy. And the important point about this is, if it were easy, I think any historian worth their salt would think, oh, this is beginning to look like a put-up job. This is beginning to look like a fraud. What the Gospels look like is relatively honest, slightly confused reporting of very confusing events. And the last major point I want to make is that if you were making up resurrection accounts, you wouldn't do it this way. Particularly, you wouldn't have Mary of Magdala as the first witness to Jesus' resurrection. Now, the reason you wouldn't choose Mary, well, there are actually two reasons, and half of you are going to hate them, the female half. The first reason is that both in Roman and in Jewish courts, women were not permitted to give testimony. And the reason they weren't was that they weren't considered to be sufficiently rational. Women were not reliable witnesses. The second reason is that Mary Magdalene is described in another place in the Gospels as being the one out of whom Jesus had cast seven demons. So now not only do we have an unreliable woman, but we have an unreliable woman with a history of mental illness. To put it really bluntly, if I was choosing a reliable first witness to the resurrection of Jesus, I wouldn't have picked Mary Magdalene. She just doesn't strike me as credible. And I think the only reason she's there in the accounts is bluntly that she was the one and they were stuck with it. And so they reported it. In other words, in various ways, I think what we see here in the Gospels is reasonably careful, conservative reporting and transmission of the traditions about the resurrection, without it being garbled in transmission by a whole lot of theological overlays and then polished and cut and shaped to make it more credible. That doesn't seem to have happened very much. Which leads us to our third question. The third question is, where might the idea... No, let me explain what I'm not asking. The standard question to ask at this point is this. Where might the idea that Jesus had risen from the dead come from? And then we talk about the disciples stole the body, or he wasn't really dead, or, and we go through the list. That's not the question I'm asking. The question I'm asking is this. Where might the idea that anyone might rise from the dead come from in the ancient world? In principle, where might the idea come from? And we have two basic choices. It could either be in the Jewish world, that the Gospels describe for us and where early Christianity began, or it could be in the Greco-Roman world to which Christianity spread after less than 10 years and began to spread and spread in that area beyond its spread within Judaism. Now, first of all, would the idea of a resurrection have made sense in the Greco-Roman world, such that you could argue, oh, look, it's just been invented by Greco-Roman people. It doesn't actually go back to the earlier stages of Christianity at all. My problem with this hypothesis is that there's actually very little strong evidence that Greco-Roman people in general believed in life after death at all. In the sands in Egypt, there are tens of thousands of papyri, ancient documents which the hot, dry sands have preserved for thousands of years. And they include thousands of letters, and those letters include letters of condolence written to people who've died, written to people whose relatives have died. Sorry about that. And I've read quite a few of these letters. And the thing I discover is they're not very consoling. Do you know, in all the letters that I've read, I have never yet found one that says, "Don't grieve because your beloved is in a far better place." They just don't say that. What they normally say is, "Console yourself because this is the common fate of all humanity and no one can escape death." Well, thank you very much. I feel better already. In other words, the letters of consolation that we have left behind in Egypt, and they don't survive anywhere else simply because anywhere else it rains and papyrus rots, but in Egypt away from the Nile Delta it simply never rains, so the papyri survive. The point is this. I don't see much evidence that many Greco-Roman people believed in life after death. And I think those that did were not very clear on the subject. Now, there are exceptions to this. There are members of mystery cults, particular Greco-Roman religions, who believed in life after death. There were some who believed in life after death from a philosophical point of view. But the thing you need to know about that is they did not believe in a physical life after death. Greco-Roman people who did believe in life after death believed that what happened when you died was that your body gave up your soul, and your soul, which was the pure you, the rational, mental part of you, was then released, and very grateful to be released. And this was formulated by a number of ancient writers, most particularly Plato, in three or four different places, but in other writers down to the first century and second century AD. It was formulated in a very simple Greek poem, which in English translates as, "The body is a tomb." You know, while you're alive, your soul is buried in your body and cannot escape. When you die, your soul is free. The body is a tomb. But in Greek, it's just two words, soma, sema. Soma, the body, is sema, a tomb. This was the widespread view among people who did believe in life after death. And that's not what the resurrection is claimed to be about. It is not saying that Jesus' soul is now free to be with God. It is saying he's back with a new body. And to put it bluntly, in Greco-Roman terms, that's a retrograde step. The whole point about dying for a Greco-Roman person who believes in life after death is that you are finally free from this dreadful physicality, that your soul is now in the higher realms of pure spirit. To get a new body, well, that's a big backward step. In other words, what I'm saying is this. Given what we know about Greco-Roman beliefs, it is most unlikely that the idea of the resurrection was invented by someone in the Greco-Roman world. It's simply the wrong sort of idea. They didn't believe in life after death like that. Part two. What about possibilities in the Jewish world? Obviously, Jewish people believed in the great resurrection at the end of history, when everyone would be brought back to life, some to face judgment, others to enter the kingdom of God. But the point about this is that it happens at the end of the world. I mean, that is the point. That's what it has to be. And you can get this if you just read John chapter 11, where Jesus comes to see the tomb of Lazarus, and where Mary and Martha are there with him, and Mary says, "If you'd been here, Lord, he wouldn't have died." And Jesus says, "He will rise again, Mary." And she says, "Well, I know he will rise again at the last day." And you know what Jesus is thinking? He's thinking, "No, actually, a little bit sooner than that." But the point is, if you say, "When's the resurrection?" Jewish people just take it for granted. You mean, at the end of the world. So where does the idea come from that one person could be raised from the dead in the middle of history and it didn't bring on the end of the world? Where does that idea come from? Particularly because it seems such a paradox. Because if you say to a Jewish person in this century, someone has risen from the dead, you might as well be saying, well, the end of the world has come, a little bit. And the way they're going to react to that is, the end of the world is not something that happens a little bit. It either happens or it doesn't. What you're saying is silly. And yet the early Christians consistently argued that Jesus had risen from the dead in the midst of human history, and that his resurrection was the beginning of the great resurrection to come, and that it happened now a little bit. Not only that, but when we look at the Jewish evidence, we discover no suggestion in the world of the Gospels that anyone thought that the Messiah would die and rise again, that the Son of Man would die and rise again. The idea that someone significant to God's plans would die and rise again is an idea out of nowhere, which makes it historically very puzzling. Finally, we come to my fourth question, which is, how was this argued in terms of the religious propaganda of the ancient world? And to illustrate this, I've given you some examples of religious and philosophical propaganda that was known in the period of the first century when the early Christians were writing. Some of it is quite a bit earlier, some of it is a little bit later. In other words, I've bracketed the New Testament period. Heraclitus the philosopher, writing in the 6th century BC, argued as follows. Although the word always exists, for those of you who know Greek, the logos, a highly significant word in the history of the Greek language, he means the underlying logical principle that makes sense of the universe. Though the word always exists, men are without understanding both before they hear it and after they've heard it for the first time. Men do not know what they're doing even when they're awake, in the same way that they forget what they do while they're awake when they're asleep. In other words, there's a central philosophical truth about the nature of the universe that most people might as well be snoring through. They just don't notice. But Heraclitus knows. Or take Zeno, the Stoic philosopher, from the 3rd century BC, who argued you could know the truth about the existence of God from sheer logic. With me on this? Ready? Zeno used to put forward the following argument. Point one, it is reasonable to honour the gods. Point two, but it is not reasonable to honour beings which do not exist. Therefore, the gods exist. Oh, I've got a feeling there's something just ever so slightly dodgy about that argument. But you see, it's an argument that works perfectly well in a culture which takes it for granted that the gods exist. In other words, it's an argument that works if you believe it already. It's a bit like the argument some Christians use, which is that the Bible must be the word of God because it says so. It's an argument that only works if you believe it already. So you have arguments from the authority of a philosopher, you have arguments from logic. Apollonius of Tyana was approximately a contemporary of Jesus and Paul, perhaps closer to Paul than to Jesus. But the report of him in Philostratus' 3rd century Life of Apollonius has him arguing his philosophical point of view as follows. When a certain quibbler asked Apollonius why he did not inquire after knowledge, Apollonius replied, "Because I asked questions when I was a youth. And now it is not my business to ask questions, but to teach people what I've discovered." "How then," the other asked him, "O Apollonius, should the wise man speak?" "Like a lawgiver," Apollonius replied, "for it is the duty of a lawgiver to deliver to the masses those instructions of whose truth he has persuaded himself." This was the line of thought he pursued during his stay in Antioch, winning the admiration of even the most unrefined people. How do you know what Apollonius says is true? Because he's a philosopher. And he spent years working this stuff out, and now it's his job to tell you. That's how you know. Or take a document from the 2nd century AD from the Corpus Hermeticum, mystical works, particularly the one called Poimandras, which is of somebody having a visionary experience. It happened that, after I had begun to reflect on the things that are, and my thoughts had been caught up on high, and when my bodily senses had been put under restraint like those who are weighed down by sleep resulting from overeating or physical fatigue, I seemed to see an immense figure of boundless size who was calling me by name. He was saying to me, "What do you wish to hear and to behold, and by your thought to learn and know?" "Who are you?" I said. "I am Poimandras," he said, "the mind of sovereignty. I know what you wish, and I am with you everywhere." "I wish," I said, "to learn the things that are, and to understand their nature, and to know God. Oh, how I wish to see this." How do you know that the writer of Poimandras knows the truth? Because he's had a mystical experience. He's seen a vision of a great heavenly being, and that's how you know. Now, I'm going to skip the next two because I've run out of time here, and we can skip them without losing anything. What I'd like you to do is simply compare and contrast what these Greco-Roman writers are saying with what St. Paul says, which is, he was seen first by Mary. No, Paul doesn't say that. He was seen by this person, by that person, by Peter, then by more than 500 of the brothers, most of whom are still alive. Go and ask them. Not believe me because of pure logic, not believe me because I've had a mystical vision, not believe me because I'm a teacher of religion and respectable and you should believe me because I've persuaded myself, but believe me because I've got more than 500 eyewitnesses, most of whom are still alive. It's different, isn't it? And you see, the difference is because of this. In the Greco-Roman world, philosophical logic, or mythology, or visions were a perfectly acceptable way to argue for a religious or philosophical point of view. Mythology was not a bad word. When a Greco-Roman person said, "This is a myth," they did not mean, "It's wrong, don't take any notice of it." When they said, "This is a myth," they meant, "This is not literally true, but it is profoundly true." It's the same as when we talk about poetic truth. Not literal, but very real. So to argue from mythology would have been perfectly acceptable. And the early Christians don't. Particularly St. Paul reports what eyewitnesses said and what he had heard, which went back to within less than 10 years of the events. That is what I personally find the most convincing about these reports. They could have used mythology, they could have used authority, they could have used visions, and instead they said, "We've got eyewitnesses." Now, let me be clear about what this does and does not prove. I don't think the argument I have put to you tonight proves that the resurrection happened. Because finally, somebody could argue that regardless of how unlikely the alternatives are, the alternatives, the disciples stole the body, he wasn't really dead, etc., etc., regardless of how unlikely those are, they are less unlikely than a resurrection. But it seems to me that argument leaves you in an awkward position. Number one, the belief is attested early, close to the events. Number two, the later reports seem to have been careful about passing on the information and not to have embellished it. Number three, the idea of a resurrection does not seem a credible one to develop either in the Jewish world or the Greco-Roman world. And number four, they will insist on quoting facts. It seems to me, on the basis of these 4 points, that historically I simply do not have an explanation for how the belief in the resurrection of Jesus grew and developed. Unless, of course, it happened. I don't have a better historical explanation than the one the early Christians gave. That doesn't prove it happened, but it does put the ball in the court of anyone who wants to say it didn't, to come up with something halfway plausible as an alternative explanation that will cover the points I've been making. Okay, I believe we have a breather now, or do we have quick questions first?
Thank you very much for that. We will have a break now. We'll have about 20 minutes. There are some snacks outside, if you'd like to go outside. I believe that Dr. Forbes will be snacking with you, so you can start the questions a little bit early, if he doesn't mind. but we'll gather again at 8:05, if we could, please. So I'll come out and ring the bells at 8:05, and we'll come back for the questions. What we might do is, Mary over there has some paper and pens. We might just put them near the back door there. And if anyone would like to write a question in during the break, please feel free, and we might use those to start off the Q&A session. So snack away. Okay, everybody, if we could please take our seats and tune our voices. We need just two nimble people to man the two microphones, if we could. So who wants to do that? Don't all jump up at once. Anyone? Anyone? Okay, we'll get someone, don't worry. What we're going to do, we're going to invite Chris back to the podium once again. He's got a couple of written questions which we might use to kick off the Q&A session. But after that, we will have the microphones. All I ask you is, please, when you ask a question, it's not that we want to embarrass you or anything, but this is a big church, and if you don't use the microphone, people won't hear what you're saying. So please don't sort of be shy, okay? And as we said, all questions are welcome. So, Dr. Forbes, if you'd like to please come back.
Now, if I say anything, is that going to happen again? We'll see how we go. I have a series of questions here, but there's one question that I was asked during the break, and I've just had time to check my references. So it was this group of guys, wasn't it? Yes. The Gospel of Peter. The reference to the Gospel of Peter is in Eusebius's History of the Church, and Eusebius says that Bishop Serapion of Antioch, and he was bishop around about 190 AD, had to deal with a group of Christians who had something they called the Gospel of Peter. And he quotes a section of it. Unfortunately, it doesn't cross over with the one we've got, but that could be true because the one we've got is only half or less than half of the book anyway. But the point is, Serapion of Antioch, around about 190 new people who were using it, so it's earlier than that, if it's the same book, which it probably is. Yep. Okay, now we have a series of questions, and then I'm quite happy to throw it wide open for others. I'll go from ones that aren't directly relevant but interesting, and then come to some of the ones that are directly relevant. The not directly relevant but interesting one is, do archaeologists give consideration to the Shroud of Turin? The answer to that is they used to. I think of all the relics that claim to be, excuse me, directly relics of the life of Jesus, the Shroud of Turin for a long time looked like the one that had the best chance of being real. But then they carbon dated it, and the carbon date said 11th century AD. Now, carbon dating isn't perfect. There's a 3 or 4% error in any carbon date, and the further you go back, the bigger that 3 or 4% error gets in terms of years. But 11th century? No. If carbon dating says it's 11th century, then I don't know what it is, but it's not 1st century. So I think the Shroud of Turin is a fascinating and deeply puzzling object. How did it get the way it is? I think we just don't know. But as far as I can tell, the judgment of most archaeologists is not 1st century and therefore not relevant. Now, there are still some people who passionately believe in the Shroud of Turin who are counter-arguing, but I'm afraid I don't know the arguments, so I can't comment on those. Yes? I'm sorry, you'll have to speak up.
The Ray Rodriguez article in Thematica Acta, which might have the other way around, but where he sort of demonstrated that the dating had been done on the parts of the shroud that had been restored after it was almost burnt in the 15th century.
I hadn't heard that, and I can't comment on it because I don't know. I would be surprised if the people who were put on the job of carbon dating did it that badly, particularly because three independent laboratories tested three different samples. Now, what you're saying is possible, but I'm afraid I just don't know the answer beyond that point.
Mm.
But the debate certainly continues, but I think most archaeologists have decided, let's leave that one alone. Okay, now there are a range of other questions. Do you attribute more reliability to one gospel over another? Was the question. I actually don't approach it that way. I don't approach it simply in terms of which gospel is it in, because what most historians are interested in doing is looking at the process by which the traditions about Jesus got to the gospels, and that's a combination of oral tradition, stories being passed on by word of mouth, and written. Because Luke, when he writes his gospel, probably in the 70s or the early 80s AD, but that probably is only a probably, says that before him, many have written accounts of what's happened. Now, we actually only know of one before Luke, Mark. So what this suggests is there were several others that were written before that, and Luke has seen them or just knows about them. So what we have then between Jesus and the written Gospels is we have a period of oral tradition and a period when things begin to be written down. But as a result of that, I don't simply say this Gospel is more reliable than that Gospel. I tend to look at individual sayings or individual clusters of sayings and ask, can you see that these appear to have been embroidered or embellished over the time of the transmission? Is this one of the more likely to be reliable, or is this one of the less likely to be reliable? So, no, I don't choose one over the others, but rather look at material that comes from each of them and then test each bit of that material historically in its own right. I'm happy to have follow-up questions on that if you like. Yes?
Over the whole range of the Gospels then, without picking on a particular Gospel?
If you use the kinds of rules of thumb that historians use to test the Gospel material, then the answer is yes. There are some versions of particular sayings of Jesus that look more like they've been touched up. I'll give you one example. In all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, you have the stilling of the storm story, where Jesus is out with the disciples on a boat in the middle of the Lake of Galilee, and there's an enormous storm, and the disciples panic, and Jesus is asleep because he's not panicking, and they wake him up. Now, in Mark, what they say is, "Rabbi, don't you care that we're perishing?" Now, in Luke, they say, "Master." And in Matthew, they say, "Lord." My guess is that Mark is right, and that the other two who have a very high, the other two who, just like Mark, have a very high opinion of Jesus, as you would expect, have modified it to make it more respectful, to call him Master or Lord, rather than just Rabbi, which to them just doesn't quite sound good enough. So when you compare versions across the Gospels, you can often see that there has been a bit of development between the different Gospels, even if it's on such a small thing as what Jesus is called. And a historian's job is to try and screen out the later developments where you can detect them and to say, what's most likely to be reliable? Is that more of an answer?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else? No, on that one. Okay, a couple more questions. These are related. Is there external evidence for the, quote, many, unquote, who came out of their graves and appeared to people as documented in Matthew? The short answer to that is no. That information is only in Matthew's Gospel. And as far as I know, there's no other non-Christian evidence that talks about it at all. And I think most historians would therefore say, well, we'll put that one in the less likely basket. But it's not an absolute decision in or out. It's just, well, that story is only told by Matthew. How much weight are we going to put on it? Related to that, I'll make a general comment in a moment about how historians work. Second, the Bible states that during the resurrection, I think this actually means during the crucifixion, there was darkness over the whole earth from the sixth hour to the ninth hour. Yeah, that's the crucifixion. Is there any other non-biblical reference that can confirm these events? The answer is almost no, but not quite, because there is a discussion in later Christian writers, and I'm just trying to think of the man's name. Oh, it's gone out of my head. Julius Africanus. Julius Africanus is a second century early Christian writer who wrote quite a broad-scale history, which unfortunately only survives in tiny fragments where other people have quoted it. Julius Africanus' work does not survive as a complete manuscript anywhere. And Africanus reports that some people said there was an eclipse at that stage. Now, that won't work, unfortunately, because we know how you calculate the date of Passover, and it's on the lunar calendar. And the way you work it out at Passover, there just can't be an eclipse. It won't work. But it does show us that people were discussing the question of what the Gospels said about darkness over the whole earth. But it doesn't tell us enough to go much further than that, unfortunately. Just that the issue was being talked about in the second century. One little question that will take far too long to answer, but I'll try. Are there any contradictions in the New Testament writings compared with external or other evidence? It really depends on what you mean by a contradiction. If you mean, are there other ways of describing events, then absolutely there are. If you mean a straight out, if this is true, then that is false, then there aren't many, but there are a few. And there are puzzles that no one can solve. As an example of a puzzle that no one can solve, lots of people think they've solved it, but they don't agree. When you try to compare what you can learn about St. Paul's life from reading his letters with what you can learn about St. Paul's life by reading Acts of the Apostles, it's quite hard to jigsaw the details together. And there are two fundamentally different ways of doing it. And historians are deeply divided as to which one is right. Now, I don't think that's a contradiction, but it's a problem, nonetheless. Are there direct contradictions? There are puzzling things that may be contradictions. For example, in Acts, where Gamaliel, the Jewish elder, is in the Sanhedrin and is saying, listen, you Sanhedrin, we've got to be really careful how we handle this early Christianity business. I'm paraphrasing. Because we don't want to be found to be opposing God if this is what God is doing. Remember that recently, now I've got to get this right round, the order right round, and I probably won't. He mentions two people who started movements, one called Theudas and another without a name, simply called the Egyptian. Sorry about that. He was a terrorist. You didn't need that, I know. But the point is, Gamaliel in his speech mentions them the wrong way round historically and says, first there was this one and then later there was this other one. And from what we know from Josephus, that's the wrong way round. Now, it's possible that Gamaliel got it wrong and Luke reports what he says accurately, or it's possible that Luke got it wrong. But for whatever reason, Gamaliel in Acts and Josephus put the events the other way around. So there are things like that where there are minor historical problems, yes, but direct straight-up contradictions between what's in the New Testament and what is coming from outside evidence, not a lot. But the reason is not the most exciting reason. The reason is that for most of what's in the New Testament, we've only got the New Testament. For most of the events that the New Testament talks about, there is no other direct evidence to check. There is for some things, but not for a huge amount. What we've generally got is an enormous amount of good background about society and culture in first century Galilee in the small towns that Jesus visited, like the life and the government of the cities that St. Paul visited in Acts. We've got a lot of good background, but direct evidence about what they did? No, we've only got the New Testament for that, which makes our question, how good is the evidence of the New Testament, an even more important question. Where we can check it, it stands up pretty well, but there's a lot of places where we simply can't check because there is no other evidence. Finally, this is a big question. Are God's deaths and resurrections common in Greco-Roman mythology? Now, this is a really important question, and it came up with the guys I was talking to earlier on as well. The answer is yes and no. There are some gods that die and rise again in Greco-Roman mythology and in Egyptian mythology particularly. The most famous example are the stories of Osiris and Horus in Egypt. Now, in these stories, you have a god who is trapped by his wicked brother Seth, killed, cut up into small pieces, and the pieces scattered around Egypt so that nobody can find them and bring them all together again. And Isis has to go around Egypt collecting all the pieces and then wrapping them up together, thus creating the first mummy. That's the point of the story. This is the story about the mummification. And then he, Osiris, comes back from the dead to rule as the Lord of the underworld for eternity. Now, there's two important things you have to notice about this. Number one, he doesn't come back from the dead to life in the world. He comes back to the dead to be the king of the afterlife. So he comes back from the dead in the land of the dead. But he's the king of the dead. Not quite what the early Christians meant by resurrection, but related, I'll grant you. There are a number of other gods that are said to die and rise. Dionysus is occasionally described this way from the Greek side. There are some stories about the goddess Cybele's consort Attis. But what you need to know about all these stories is that they are not set in historical time. Not the Attis ones, not the Horus and Osiris ones. If you asked a believer in those cults, what year was it that Osiris rose from the dead, for example, they'd just look at you as if you were odd. And they'd look at you as if you were odd for the same reason that an Australian Aboriginal would look at you as if you were odd if you asked them, what year was it that the rainbow serpent carved out the banks of the Todd River? Because the answer is, it's not a year. It happened in the dream time. Everyone knows that. And the dream time is not history. It's more important. And in exactly the same way, Egyptian and Greco-Roman believers said, yes, there are gods that die and rise. When does it happen? In the dream time. And more specifically, Osiris. When does Osiris die and rise? Every year. Because Osiris dies every autumn as the green plants die down in autumn, and he rises again every year as the green growth comes back. That's how it happens. In other words, it's not history, it's mythology, and they mean it mythologically. Now, the important thing to notice is that that is not what the early Christians meant. They said it happened in Judea when Pontius Pilate was governor. As I said in the main talk, they could have argued mythologically, and everyone would have understood. They would have said, oh yes, Jesus rises from the dead. I understand, like Osiris. But instead, they said, no, no, you haven't got this, have you? We knew this man. We spent time with him. And it all happened, oh, about 30 years ago, while Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, which is between 26 and 36 AD, according to Josephus. So yes, there are gods that die and rise. Not many, but a few. But it's not really a very good parallel. Because they die and rise mythologically, poetically, in the changing of the seasons, in the dying and rising again of the crops. But in history? No, it's the wrong question. They're not claiming it happened in history. And the early Christians are. They may be wrong, but that's what they're claiming. Okay, those were the questions I was given. We are now open to any others as well.
Hi. You partly answered in your last answer what I'm about to ask, but maybe you can expand. In a talk you said that the point E, possible origins for the concept of resurrection. In Greco-Roman world, like everybody believed that Romulus was bodily resurrected, and in a historical time,
they believed who?
Romulus, the founder of Rome, was bodily resurrected, and Plutarch writes about it. So he was in a historical time. And all the Romans believed that their heroes was taken up to heaven or somehow resurrected. And if you look at the Jewish world, Jews believed that, you know, Moses and Elijah was taken up and they came back in a New Testament to show that there was actually resurrection, or people were taken up before Jesus. And in a vision of Gabriel that was written in stone 1st century BC, there's clearly somebody's resurrection in a historical time. We actually know the person before Jesus, risen 3 days after his death. So it was very common in that time that people were resurrected, at least the heroes. So why is Christianity any different? Like, people are resurrected in historical times, they have empty tombs, and by the way, Osiris came back to teach Horus how to fight Seth in a historical time. So there's also stories about Osiris. So to me, Christianity is nothing like a copy of other religions.
First of all, let me say which part of your question I can't answer. I can't answer the one about the so-called vision of Gabriel. I've ordered books on that into the library, but they haven't come yet. So I'm waiting to see on that one, so I simply say, don't know, I'm afraid.
I think that can be downloaded, the main scholarly work. Sorry.
I'm very interested to see this, but I haven't yet. I think there's a few questions of fact where we're disagreeing. To take the first one that you mentioned, Romulus. Plutarch doesn't say that Romulus rose from the dead. Plutarch tells, if I'm remembering correctly, it's either Plutarch or Livy, one of them tells two stories, one where Romulus was murdered, but the senators hid his body and declared that he'd ascended to the heavens, and the other in which there was a great storm and his body was nowhere to be found. Now, the important point about this is that there is a clear difference between physical resurrection and ascending to heaven, and we know this because nobody was ever found. There are many parallels, many, you are quite right, to the idea of a great mythological hero ascending to heaven. Heracles is another one of those. But the idea that someone came back from the dead and lived again in this world with a new physical body, that is not paralleled. That is what the early Christians were claiming, which is not paralleled. Now, there are plenty of ascensions to heaven, and your case of Elijah and Moses from the Hebrew Bible fits that category as well. Nobody is claiming, I think, on the Jewish side, that these people died and rose again. What we see of them is a vision of them, rather than them physically coming back. So yes, there are parallels for ascensions. There are quite a lot of parallels for ascensions. But that's not what the early Christians are claiming. They do claim Jesus ascended. But the thing they are really claiming is he started off dead and he came back to life. That's the bit that I'm claiming is unparalleled. Now, I don't know the business about the so-called vision of Gabriel. And there are several stages of argument I'd need to see laid out. And if you have the online reference, I'll get it from you later. Easy to find? Just a sec. But I think the main point is, yes, there are ascensions. No, there aren't resurrections. And I repeat the point about the Egyptian gods. They're not claiming that these were historical people. The Egyptians just didn't think that way about their gods. There are two great streams of time. There's historic time and there's mythological time. And by and large, the Greco-Roman people thought this way as well. And the resurrections happen in mythological time. That's their nature. And for Greco-Roman people, that's fine. That's okay, that's good enough. But the early Christians were making a different kind of claim. They weren't saying, Jesus comes back, brackets, all the time. And they weren't saying, as we sometimes do, loosely, I know that he lives because he lives within my heart. No, they were saying he physically came back and did things like eating fish and other boring body stuff. But at the same time was clearly more than merely physical, because he could do things like appearing inside locked rooms. And the way I described this to the guys during the break is that the early Christians are claiming that in some sense Jesus has the new Mark II improved human body, the one that doesn't wear out. And the early Christians believe the one that we will all get at our resurrection. But that's a separate issue. So I think there are genuine issues of fact that we're disagreeing about, and we could, the only way to resolve them, I'm afraid, is to go back and look at the Plutarch and see whether I've remembered it right or you have, or whether I'm remembering Livy. But my memory is that there are stories of ascensions, but not of resurrections. One, two, yes.
Thanks for an entertaining talk. If somebody makes a claim about a miracle, we have to ask what standard of evidence we would accept for us to accept that miracle has occurred. And I'm struggling to understand how documents, even if accurately transmitted and 100% absolutely true in and of themselves, could ever be evidence for a miracle. And as a corollary, is it not simply beyond the scope of a historian to make a comment about miracles, full stop?
Is it beyond the scope of a historian to make a comment about miracles, full stop? That's very much a definitional question. I take it that every historian brings with them to their historical study a set of philosophical or theological premises which they take for granted. And I take it that it's also the mark of a good historian that they are aware of their premises, and where the evidence contradicts, they at least notice that there is a problem. Now, I'm a historian who is not willing to rule out the possibility of miracles, but I am certainly one who wants a pretty high grade of evidence before I'm going to take much time over it. I think that's absolutely reasonable, and the way you formulated the question reminded me of the claim that, you know, ordinary claims require ordinary evidence, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that's, you see, why I said very carefully that I did not think my argument proved the resurrection, because I don't think it does. I don't think you can prove the resurrection. What you can show is that if the resurrection did not happen, there are some very serious historical puzzles for which there is no obvious answer. Now, the way this was formulated 35-odd years ago by Professor Charlie Moule at Cambridge University, I think is very nice. Moule was one of the greatest 20th century New Testament scholars, and he said, if early Christianity tears a hole in history, and that hole is roughly the size and shape of a resurrection, then what I want to know is, what's the secular historian going to do about it? And that's essentially what I'm saying. I'm saying that I cannot see a good explanation that has any great historical credibility. And the only explanation that's left standing is the one the early Christians made, which looks surprisingly good. That's as far as I can go as a historian. You're quite right. Beyond that, I probably cannot go. But what I can do is lay out the facts as we can see them and say, now here's the problem. If it's not a resurrection, what is it? And whatever explanation you put up has got to be tested fairly. And if it's possible, but not very likely, then you and I at some point may disagree, and you may say, well, anything's more likely than a resurrection. And I may say, well, I'm not sure I'm going to take that position. So there is a philosophical difference that we're stuck with here if you decide that a resurrection simply isn't possible. If you say that, then I'll say, okay, if that's the case, we really can't take the argument any further. But if a resurrection is at least in theory possible, if there is a God who can do such things, then we've got an argument we can go from. Is that at least partially an answer to the question? I'm happy with that too, because I think theology has to be based on history. Sorry, next one.
If there are puzzles, thanks. I just wanted to tail end of what your answer to this gentleman here. You said that if we don't have a good explanation, a natural explanation, then we are left with a very unusual puzzle. Then wouldn't it be reasonable, instead of jumping the gun and making a or accepting a supernatural claim, wouldn't it be more plausible to say we don't know? Maybe in the future we'll find out. Why do we have to jump to a supernatural explanation for it?
It's a good question, and I think the strong answer, or the strongest answer I have, is two things. Number one, it's a very frustrating situation on something as important as this to simply say, well, I have no idea what happened, but it can't be that.
Well, anything's possible, but, you know...
No. Anything's possible, but not anything is likely.
Right, well, that's what I was going to say next.
Yeah.
So, well, instead of trying to, you know, lean towards, you know, what's more likely than the other, and one happens to be, you know, supernatural, and what's the likelihood of something so supernatural like that happening versus what's the likelihood of something natural happening, and then going for the less... they're too... It's kind of weird, but... I mean, why don't you just say that we may figure out in the future once we get more information, and perhaps if Jesus is real, you know, then he may reveal certain information for us to accept it with more certainty.
Number one, I can't do that as an historian.
You can't say, I don't know, as a historian?
Oh, no. I can't say, maybe Jesus will tell us, as a historian. I could certainly say, we don't have enough information. I just simply don't think that's true. I think we have information that strongly suggests that something truly remarkable happened.
But, well, from what I'm hearing, is that... I mean, to me, it sounds like a logical fallacy, because you're saying, well, we can't disprove that Jesus rose from the dead, so therefore he did.
That's not what I'm saying. And
well,
if I were, it would be a logical fallacy. You're quite right.
Right.
But I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there is only one explanation on the table which seems to make historical sense. If you want to say, but a priori, I'm crossing that one off because such things can't happen, then at that point I say, well, that's a theological position that you've taken.
I'm not saying that it can't happen. I'm saying that you're saying that we can't find any ulterior explanation. You're saying that I don't have enough information, so based on my lack of information, I'm going to go ahead and conclude anyway.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there are a number of historical puzzles which are resolved by the hypothesis of resurrection that I do not think are resolved any other way. Tell me why I shouldn't go for the hypothesis that does resolve them.
Well, because it would then be just a Band-Aid. I mean, what other reason besides, oh, it fills the gap, God did it, what other reason do you have to accept it?
I'd say it's a good Band-Aid. If it explains the data and nothing else does, then that'll do me.
So you're saying the best explanation because it's the best explanation?
I'm saying that it is an explanation that just go back to my four questions. It answers my four questions. It says the evidence is early. It says the evidence has been cautiously, I'm not claiming perfectly, the evidence has been cautiously transmitted. There's no other obvious source for the idea, and given that the early Christians could have argued from mythology and didn't, it all adds up to a fairly impressive case that they cared about fact and made claims about fact. Now, that only takes us so far, but my point, I think, that I want to make very clear is that everyone has a priori premises. Some people have an a priori premise that a resurrection, if not impossible, is so unlikely as to be absurd and not worth thinking about. Some people have an a priori premise that God exists and could do such a thing. Some people have an a priori premise that says it is at least possible that a God exists. Now, the trouble is, all of these are theological positions, and as far as I can tell, none of them has the right to be considered the only possible one or the only unbiased one. They're simply different theological positions. Now, the question is, can the person who holds the one different from mine come up with an hypothesis superior in terms of explaining the evidence? And if they can, I want to hear it. Seriously, because if this is not true, I want to know. Because I'm wasting an awful lot of my time driving out to Mount Druitt and giving talks. And other things too.
Right. Well, I will just conclude that I don't know. And, you know, if in the future, I mean, if you're willing to accept that there is a God and that that is the best explanation, that Jesus did exist and that he rose from the dead, then wouldn't you then kind of conclude that he still exists now and then could provide us with the information?
He could. Absolutely.
Right. So I would say, you know, why didn't you just wait till that? Because, I mean, as a historian, I think you probably just addressed
this. I think
this
that's
before.
Almost as frustrating as your position.
Sorry.
Because your position is to say, we don't know, and to be frustrated about that.
I'm not
and
frustrated.
And my position is, well,
I'm not frustrated.
Sorry.
I'm fine with I don't know. I'm fine with that. But what I'm trying to say is, why aren't you fine with that?
I guess what I should have said is I would be almost as frustrated as I would be with your position. I'd be frustrated having to say, I don't know, because I'm relentlessly curious. But I would be equally frustrated saying, well, we'll just have to wait for Jesus to tell us, because
well, if you cared about
might
your...
not.
Right, but I guess this is all about, you know, if you want to be... If you want to be intellectually honest, I guess I'm not saying that you're not, but for me, I would much rather wait before I conclude something based on document and text than, you know, I'd much rather wait and see before I make a decision as to whether, based on, I don't know, we can't find another explanation.
A reasonable position.
Cool.
Right. It may be right, it may be wrong, but it's reasonable. Sure. There's a question coming here.
One of the arguments against the resurrection, as posed from St. Mark's Gospel being the first written account of the Gospels,
yes,
is the last couple of verses in Matthew 16:9-20, which is a lot of scholars have said that it's not the, that segment.
Sorry, did you mean Mark?
Yeah. Mark 16:20.
Yes.
Which a lot of the scholars have said that it's not part of the original manuscripts and it's only been added, and it could prove an argument against that Mark did not record it himself. Can you shed some light on that?
Yes.
From your studies, please.
Yes. The great majority, as in the overwhelming majority of scholars, think that Mark's Gospel ended with the words, and the women told no one because they were afraid. That's really quite baffling, because either Mark did write more of an ending, but that bit got torn off and nobody ever knew what it was in some way. That's one possibility. Don't know how you'd prove or disprove it, but it's a possibility. The other possibility is that Mark deliberately ended on a cliffhanger. Now, not everyone finds this persuasive, but I think it's a reasonably good explanation. I think Mark deliberately left with a cliffhanger. He left with the angel saying, he's risen and going to Galilee. And the women were terrified. And now it's over to you. Mark could be doing that. But I think it is most likely that Mark is deliberately ending on a cliffhanger to make his audience think and respond and react. Yes, I think that the other longer endings to Mark are probably added, we don't know for sure, but 100 AD and shortly afterwards, by people who found the ending of Mark really unsatisfactory. So they created one. But the great majority of the better manuscripts suggest it ended with, and the women ran away afraid. I don't think so, because I think it's absolutely clear that Luke is telling us there was a Mark was telling us there was a resurrection. He's deliberately leaving us hanging with it. Not only that, but Matthew and Luke clearly have other sources of information as well as Mark. For a start, they have quite a lot of material in common, which they didn't get from Mark because it's not in Mark. So there's other sources of information available. So no, I'm not surprised that Matthew and Luke have extra things about the resurrection that Mark doesn't. Plus, of course, we've got the evidence of Paul. Anybody else? Yes, and then back to you.
Wikipedia tells us that the book of Luke was likely not written by Luke. So if we get some conclusive evidence down the track that that's true, how would that affect the credibility of the gospel?
And if it's wrong, how will it affect the credibility of Wikipedia? I have to tell you, any comment that starts with the words Wikipedia tells us... Oh, no.
There's like a lot of... On Wikipedia, it says that a lot of Catholic theologians, are in that belief that Luke didn't write Luke. So I just want your thoughts on it there.
Yes. There is a division in scholarship about whether Luke's Gospel and Acts were written by the person we think they are. There is virtually no disagreement at all that they are written by the same person. I think it's absolutely clear that they were conceived of as a two-volume work, the first bit about Jesus, the second about the early church, and that they're written with interconnected themes running through the whole thing. So Luke's Gospel, so-called, and the Acts of the Apostles, I think, are clearly written by the same person. Now, the question is this person, Luke, the travelling companion of St. Paul, who he appears to be in Acts and who is explicitly mentioned in Colossians as Luke the physician? Scholars do disagree about this. I don't know what the percentages are. I myself think it is highly likely that he was the travelling companion of Paul, and the main reason I think that is that when you look at the passages in Acts where Acts shifts from talking about what they did to talking about what we did, these are the so-called we passages in Acts, I think easily the best explanation of them is that they are Luke referring to his own travel diaries. Or perhaps just to his own memories. So yes, there is dispute about this, but there's still a very respectable view that says, yes, it is that Luke. If it isn't, it is still written by someone who knows the situation in the mid-first century in the Eastern Mediterranean extremely well. And where we can check him, his detail is very, very good. If you just read through Acts and look at the different places that they stop on their journey. And you look at the technical terminology that Acts uses to describe trade routes, local government, various issues to do with the circumstances in that period. He never gets it wrong. Here's an example for you. There's one odd little reference When St. Paul is in Ephesus, this is Acts 16? Not sure now. Anyway, in Ephesus, and there's the riot of the silversmiths in Ephesus, and an enormous crowd gathers in the theatre at Ephesus, which is immense. The theatre at Ephesus will hold 30,000 people. It's one of the most dramatic places that you can visit in Turkey. It's really, really worth it. There's a riot going on in there, and the city councillor calls the meeting to order and basically says, look, if these men have done anything illegal, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Take them to the courts. Okay? Otherwise, if we keep this up, we're going to be charged with having a riotous assembly here and that'll be trouble. Now, there's one little phrase there that is very peculiar for a Roman historian, because a Roman historian sees the phrase, the courts are open and there are proconsuls, and says, hang on, that's wrong. In any one place, there is only one person who is proconsul. The Romans only send out one proconsular governor to any region. So what does it mean to say there are proconsuls? Well, if you look in the Roman historian Cassius Dio, you discover that in just that 8-year slot, the Roman proconsular governor died in office and two officials stood in for him. And it's just a little throwaway comment in the text of Acts that doesn't appear to make sense until you lock it in with another reference from another historian, and then it seems awfully credible. So what I'm actually saying here is, yes, there is a dispute about whether it was really written by Luke, the travelling companion of Paul. I think it was. But even if it wasn't, it's awfully good on detail. Can I throw in one more comment about Wikipedia? Some parts of Wikipedia are first rate. Others are bunkum. The trick is knowing which is which. And my students sometimes don't pick it. I got an essay last semester. This was in November. And it was an essay about Alexander the Great and his conquests. And there was one sentence or paragraph that was in one fairly straightforward English style. Then there was another paragraph that was in a completely different style, and then a paragraph that went back to the first style. Suspicious. And in the second paragraph that was in the different style, there was at least one word that I'd never seen before, and I was fairly sure the student didn't know what it meant either. So I used the most sophisticated anti-plagiarism software. It's called Google. And it took me straight to Wikipedia. They had copied the whole paragraph straight out of Wikipedia, and the trouble is, A, they didn't footnote it, so they fail. That's plagiarism. B, it was a really bad article. I'm really tempted to go back and correct about 6 points of detail in it, but I'm not going to, because I may catch someone else. Say again, sorry? Josephus? I don't think he had access to Wikipedia. Sorry, you're referring to... it wasn't by Josephus. It was by some Slavonic monks in the 6th and 7th century. But there is another brief reference to Jesus which is not in doubt, where he's simply mentioned as the brother of James. But the point about that reference is it seems to presume that you're meant to know who he's talking about. So, along with most historians, I strongly suspect that there was something originally in Josephus about Jesus, but it has been doctored by Christian scribes. But there was something there. And the winner is? Sorry, here's a question. One of my anti-gospel friends often tells me that people were illiterate, so even though the gospels were written close to the time, no one knew how to read it. Can you help me on this one? Yes, I can. Literacy had been around in the Greco-Roman world for at least 700 years before the Gospels. Probably less than 10% of people were literate. Probably. But that's a really rough guess. We don't actually know. So there were literate people, and even farming villages in Galilee would probably have the local scribe whose job it was to read government notices for the farmers who couldn't read them and to write letters back for people who didn't know how to write. There was a sprinkling of literate people, and in the cities there were more of them. So there were literate people around, and there are two things that this suggests to me. The first thing it suggests is important because it's about oral tradition. We are really technology dependent. I can't even go shopping without a shopping list with any confidence that I can remember all the items I need. We're just used to the fact we can scribble a list. I can't even write a lecture without a word processor that does outlining. I'm really, you know, hooked. Technologically dependent. People who don't have these tools learn to use their memories. There were scribes in the Jewish world who had literally memorized the entire Hebrew Bible. That's mind-boggling. In the Greco-Roman world, there were performers of poetry who had memorized the entire works of Homer, Iliad and Odyssey and more. In a culture where you are not as dependent on writing, even if you have access to writing, you just plain practice your memory more and you're good at it as a result. Now that doesn't prove in any sense that they got everything right, but it shows there is the potential for good transmission of information. And there's more potential if two things happen. Number one, if you are formally taught to memorize the teachings you're going to be passing on. And number two, if there's more than one person involved in passing it on. If there's a whole community involved in passing it on, then they can cross-check with each other and the chances are that the transmission will work better. Add the final point to this, which is that the Gospels are written still within the lifetime of eyewitnesses, so you have the possibility not only of cross-checking between people passing on the story, but the possibility of cross-checking with actual eyewitnesses. I'm not arguing that this proves that the reporting is accurate. I'm arguing that it makes it more likely that it is. Partly an answer to the question and partly some extra bits. We've got a queue now. It's 9:05. Father Antonius, are you happy just to continue for a little while? Okay, we'll see how we go. I'm going to work this way across the room, so yes, first of all. Okay. The question, for those who couldn't quite hear it, is how do we know that the documents we have in the New Testament are the way they were originally written way back in the first century? The answer to this is fairly straightforward. We have copies of thousands of different works from the ancient world. In some cases we only have one or two manuscripts, and in some cases we only have manuscripts written several centuries after the originals. For Tacitus, the Roman historian, for Herodotus, the Greek historian, the main manuscripts that we have come from around about 500 or 600 AD. In one case, 500 years after the originals. In another, nearly 1,000 years after the originals. But we don't just have one copy. We have multiple copies. And so what we can do is put them together, look at them, and construct a likely history of where the mistakes came in by comparing what's in one document with what's in another. And you'll see some things that are obviously just copying errors, where a line's got missed out, or where a sentence has been doubled, or where a word has become incomprehensible because the scribe couldn't read it and so wrote what they thought it was. Those are the sort of things you can compare between manuscripts and check. We have more manuscripts of the books of the New Testament than we have of any other ancient document, bar none. We are better off. I'm not saying it's perfect. If you have a modern translation of the Bible, occasionally you'll see a footnote that says some other manuscripts say such and such. And they're telling you that there are minor differences. But the point is, the differences are relatively minor. We are better off for the text of the New Testament than we are for any other ancient book. Next up. Yes, and then we'll move across.
Who said there was a man who was named Jesus that claimed, or people around him were claiming that he resurrected from the dead? Are there any historians that wrote about that?
Yes and no. There are a number of historians writing within a century after the events, writing about the time, who briefly mention Jesus. They don't tell us very much, but they do tell us that they knew he was there. The Roman historian Tacitus, talking about the persecution of the Christians in Rome at the time of the Emperor Nero, says that they got their name from the founder of the movement, who was executed by Pontius Pilate. And he knows that this person's name was Christ, hence Christian. Not quite a name, actually, more like a title. So Tacitus is a little bit muddled on the details, but he knows that the word Christ was being used as Jesus' name in his time. So Tacitus tells us a little bit. What he tells us is there was this person under Pontius Pilate who still had followers later. Josephus, we've touched on this one already, there are two passages in Josephus that mention Jesus. One of them has been doctored by Christian scribes. And my guess is that this is because it said something like, this man claimed to be the Messiah. And the Christian scribe in the 6th or 7th century said, oh, no, this man was the Messiah, and corrected the text. And so the text got corrupted. But it is highly likely that there was something there about Jesus to start with. Then there's one passage in Suetonius, the biographer of Claudius and Nero, who talks about the Christians in Rome, or rather talks about the fact that there had been riots among the Jews because of someone called Crestus. Possibly that's another reference to Jesus. It's not much. There's one or two other documents. There's one papyrus called the Letter of Marabas Serapion, written somewhere after 70 AD because he knows the temple in Jerusalem has been destroyed, and that happened in 70 AD. And he says, and he's not a Christian, nor I think Jewish, he simply says, what benefit did the Jewish people get from killing their wise king? After all, look what happened to their temple. Now, I can't think of anyone else he can mean except Jesus, because there's no one else claiming to be a king of the Jews who was executed for it, who is likely to be known. So the answer to your question is, there's not much, but there is some. About the resurrection? Just the report that people believed it. That's all. Across the room. Yes, to the back.
I just wanted to ask if you said the earliest recount was 9 years post the resurrection. So the people obviously at the time were those who may have known or heard of Jesus before he died. Why wouldn't they have, gone against those writings? And if they did, is there any still plausibility or feasibility for those documents to still be even though they may be incorrect, still live on and not be corrupted by those who disagreed and thought it was false.
I'm sorry, I don't think I'm quite understanding your question.
So why didn't the people at the time put that rumour to bed?
Why didn't people who didn't believe in the resurrection...
Yeah, so if the event didn't happen and there was a group of people claiming that it did...
Yes.
The majority of the others who thought, no, this is, you know, this is a rumour that is within this Christian group, we will put this rumour to bed and destroy all these documents and so forth, how could it live on?
It's hypothetically possible that something like that happened. The trouble is...
There's no evidence of it?
No, that's the thing. There is a gap, there is a lack of evidence in general. I think I said earlier on in my answer to the question about Acts that there's an awful lot in the Gospels for which the Gospels are all we have. Now that's, could just be because what you're suggesting didn't happen and so there was nothing to report. Or it could be that what you're suggesting did happen but nobody bothered to write it down, they just did it at a verbal level because the whole culture worked at a verbal level, so over time the information was lost. It's also possible that it was written down and lost. But no later writer talking about this period tells us anything about someone dismissing the whole story as rubbish at the time. Now, there are various possible explanations for that, but there is no mention of it. Best we can say, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Next up was... Yes, back to you.
You talked about the women at the tomb and you said that women's testimony are worthless. I was wondering, why do you think so? Because Talmud clearly writes that women's testimony was worth half of men.
Sorry, who says this?
It's Jewish writings, Talmud,
mm-hmm.
that women's testimony is about half of a men's testimony in a matters that is related to women. And clearly, mourning of dead is women's business. Wouldn't the readers of the gospel expect women to be at the tomb rather than men? Because it's exactly the same as Osiris' story or Baal's story that were very popular at the time.
Two things. Number one, the later evidence of the Talmud may or may not be accurate for the first century. The Talmud is a 6th century AD document. Or rather, both Talmuds are 5th and 6th century. The Jerusalem and the Babylonian Talmud come from much later. We don't know, therefore, with any confidence whether the same rules applied in the 1st century. What is strongly suggested by other Jewish writers in the 1st century and in the early... Well, no, Josephus is late 1st century. So by Jewish writers in the 1st century is that women's testimony was not accepted unless corroborated by other evidence, which is similar to what you're saying from the Talmud, that their evidence is worth half as much. So clearly there was a strong sense that women's testimony was not good testimony unless corroborated preferably by a man. So yes, I think that far we virtually agree. Wouldn't people think women would be the first witnesses? That's possible, because women did take a particular part in burial ceremonies, and not just in the myths either, but in historical reality. In fact, I think that's why they did in the myths, because the myths were building on historical reality, or at least were written taking account of historical cultural reality. Yes, you would expect women to be near the tomb, but you wouldn't pick someone with a history of having... possession by demons as a reliable witness. You'd pick one of the other more reliable women, surely, and have a man there as well. Or at least you would if you were mocking up an account. What I'm arguing is only one thing, which is that the early Christians had to report it was Mary Magdalene. Because it was. Because inventing her as the first witness would be silly. Sorry, was that a follow-on question?
Wouldn't the writers have been smart enough to know that you'd think that?
I mean, here we get into a logical problem.
Yeah.
If we decide that the writers are smart enough to be tricking us by making themselves look stupid, then what we have to ask is, what is the evidence for this theory that the writers are clever enough to make themselves look stupid? And the trouble is, that kind of theory is by its nature very difficult to argue, because you've got to argue that it must be right because there's no evidence. See how clever they were. It's just not a hypothesis you can easily make. I think that the real answer to your question is the gospel writers aren't stupid, but they don't give the impression of being towering intellects either. They look like reasonably educated for the time, literate but not high literary people. So I think building the hypothesis that they may be being too clever by half may itself be too clever by half. Last chance, I think. Quickly. Last chance. What I'll do is I'll dodge the question but tell you how to find out. I am not particularly an expert on John's Gospel. I'm much more an expert on St. Paul and on the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and the historical Jesus question. John is a whole other field of study of great complexity, and I just say, ooh, it'd be nice to know about that. But there has recently been a major book written on eyewitness testimony in the early Christian world in general. It's written by Richard Bauckham, Bauckham. It's simply called The Eyewitnesses, with a subtitle about in early Christianity. I forget the detail. And Bauckham has also written quite a bit about the likelihood of John's gospel being eyewitness. Now, not everyone by a long chalk agrees with Bauckham, but he's the one making the running on that argument, if you want to follow it up. Father Antonius.
Well, I think we'd all agree tonight on one thing, that it was not only an extremely informative night, but also quite an entertaining one. I think we'd all agree that it was a wonderful presentation. To express our thanks to Dr. Forbes for coming tonight, we have some extremely expensive and valuable gifts. We have this very valuable Coptic diary for 2012, which still has 3/4 of a year to run. So we have this ancient Coptic icon of Saint Damiana, and we're not just giving him one saint, but 41 today, because she has her 40 sisters with her. And I probably should disclose that it's actually a copy of an icon, not the icon. And last, but certainly not least, this wonderful little plaque from, literally, physically from, the catacombs outside Rome. It is actually from the catacombs outside of Rome. It is, though, from the souvenir shop. So thank you very much.
If I may say, if the diary still has 3/4 of a year to run, then I'm 3/4 very grateful for it.
Thank you all for coming as well. Just a final notice about next month. The topic for next month was actually touched upon in one of the questions tonight. The topic is, following on from today, the reliability of the Bible. How do we know that what was written originally was a true account? More importantly, as Dr. Forbes began to tell us tonight, how do we know that it was accurately transmitted over the 2,000 years? More details will be posted in a timely fashion on the Facebook page, Coptic Apologetics Discussion Group. Please have a look in. If you'd like to follow up on any discussions, there is a discussion board there as well. Please, by all means, continue the discussions that you began tonight and pursue them as long and as hard as you like on Facebook. Thank you all for coming, and if we could please stand up for our concluding prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen. Thank you all.